This is Chris Bacon, composer for Bates Motel, and you're listening to Good Evening.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I am Chris Haig, and I'm joined as always by my two favourite Canadians, Tatiana Maslany, notwithstanding, Brandon Shimatala and Tom Caldwell. How are you doing, guys?
Excellent. Thank you for having us.
I'm doing very good. Yes, thank you for having us. We're always pleased to be invited onto your show.
Oh, duh. I was just being like, I'm going to sound professional. And just realized, nope, sounds like I've taken over the show. So tonight's episode, episode 14, we will be covering The Manx Man, which is a 1929 British silent drama film directed by Hitchcock. It's also Hitchcock's last silent film before he moved the transition into sound film. So I know, we're all very, like... The silent films have been good, but I can't wait to hear people actually start talking.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's my thing. I'm there like, oh my god, I'll be able to actually catch on dialogue. You know, I don't have to rely on just waiting for title cards and stuff. So,
I'm just thrilled that I can surf the net on my iPad while I watch the movie.
Yes.
And not miss anything.
So many times, I really have no shame in admitting this, but so many times I've been like, yeah, I'll watch it, that sort of thing. And I've looked down at my phone and then it's like, oh, 4 plot points have gone. Because I was just listening along to like the usual background music. Before we get into them,
Tom's just considering you ungrateful swine, you uncultured swine.
How could you not concentrate entirely on the film before you?
Well, I am a millennial. It's rare that we focus on anything these days, so I am thoroughly blaming it on that. Before we jump into our discussion of The Manx Man, however, Brandon is going to talk us through a bit of the behind the scenes on the film. Brandon?
I was actually surprised with how much I was able to find on this. Again, all this information has come from Hitchcock's own and the Wikipedia pages. But the film The Manx Man was directed by Hitchcock, and it starred Annie Oundra, Carl Brisson, and Malcolm Keane. The film is based on a popular 1894 romantic novel called The Manx Man by Hall Caine, which had previously been made into a film 12 years earlier. It was the last silent film that Hitchcock directed before he moved to the transition of sound film with his next film, Blackmail. Now, we will be getting into Blackmail next time. We are aware that it was originally designed to be a sound film, or a silent film, pardon me. So we will be discussing that next time on Good Evening. Now, Wikipedia doesn't list a specific date for the release of the film, simply January of 1929, but Hitchcock's own lists it as the 21st of January. Elliot Stannard's scenario for the film marked the end of his 8-film collaboration with Hitchcock. Stannard went on to write for another 7 films before leaving the industry in the early 30s, by which time he had over 150 credits to his name.
Wow.
Filming began in August. Despite initial reports that Hitchcock would use the Isle of Man, the setting of Caine's book, location filming took place on the Cornish coastline at Polperro Harbour. And according to Donald Spotto, author of The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 years of his motion pictures, studio head John Maxwell disliked the film so much that it was temporarily shelved until a positive trade screening combined with the success of Blackmail changed his mind. In his conversations with François Truffaut, Hitchcock was dismissive, calling it a very banal picture and stating that the only point of interest about that movie is that it was my last silent one. As part of the Save the Hitchcock 9 campaign, started in 2010, the British Film Institute undertook a full restoration of The Manx Man. Unlike the other silent films, the original camera negative was available and was used for the project, which I think we'll have a little bit to talk about, because the version that we watched was just outstandingly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, not related to the movie itself, I was fascinated that they specifically mentioned that this took place on the Isle of Man. So I did a little research on the Isle of Man, partly because their flag creeps me out so much. Okay, so those that's watched the movie, the Isle of Man flag is like three legs in a circle that are like running. And so there's one at the top and two at the bottom. So if you know the Klingon symbol, it's kind of like the Klingon symbol, but with feet. So it's really creepy, and I don't know. I hope I haven't offended the 80,000 inhabitants of the Isle of Man. But the Isle of Man, also known simply as Man, is a self-governing British Crown dependency in the Irish Sea between the islands of Great Britain and Ireland. The head of state is Queen Elizabeth II, who holds the title of Lord of Man and is represented by a lieutenant governor. Now, here in Canada, we also have a lieutenant governor. Defense is the responsibility of the United Kingdom. The island has been inhabited since before 6500 BC, and Gaelic cultural influence began in the 5th century, and the Manx language, a branch of the Gaelic languages, emerged. In the year 627, Edwin of Northumbria conquered the Isle of Man along with most of Mercia. In the 9th century, Norsemen established the Kingdom of the Isles, and Magnus III, King of Norway, was also known as King of Man and the Isles between 1099 and 1103. In 1266, the island became part of Scotland under the Treaty of Perth after being ruled by Norway. After a period of alternating rule by the kings of Scotland and England, the isle came under the feudal lordship of the English crown in 1399. The lordship revested into the British crown in 1765, but the island never became part of the 18th century Kingdom of Great Britain or its successors, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, and the present-day United Kingdom. It retained its status as an internally self-governing crown dependency. The Isle of Man Parliament, Tynwald, became in 1881 the first national legislative body in the world to give women the right to vote in a general election, but this excluded married women. Now, I also wanted to look it up because I didn't quite know what it was. I wanted to look up the term Deemster. Now, Deemster is a judge in the Isle of Man specifically, so this is like a unique term for the Isle of Man. The High Court of Justice of the Isle of Man is presided over by a Deemster, or in the case of the appeal division of that court, a Deemster and the Judge of Appeal. The Deemsters also promulgate, I hope I'm saying these words right, I'm really sorry if I'm some stupid Canadian that doesn't know how to read. The Deemsters also promulgate the laws on Tynwald Day by reading them out to the people in English and Manx. In the past, the first and second Deemsters had ex officio seats in the Legislative Council of the Isle of Man. The second Deemster was removed in 1965 and the first Deemster in 1975. There are currently, as of 2017, three full-time Deemsters. These are the first Deemster and the Clerk of the Rolls, who is also the Deputy Governor, the second Deemster and an additional full-time Deemster. The offices of First Deemster, Second Deemster, and Clerk of the Rolls are ancient offices. The offices of First Deemster and Clerk of the Rolls were combined in 1918, and a new office of Deputy Deemster was created in 2002, but abolished in 2009. Additional Deemsters, full-time or part-time, may now be appointed. The present full-time additional Deemster previously held the office of Deputy Deemster, and additional part-time Deemsters are appointed from time to time to hear a particular case. And the current Deemsters are, as of 2017, the first Deemster and Clerk of the Rolls is David Doyle. The second Deemster is Andrew Corlett. Deemsters Alistair Montgomery, and the Judge of Appeal is Jeffrey Tattersall.
Interesting.
So that's kind of a little bit of interesting stuff there. Now let's jump into a little bit of the actors on the film. Carl Brisson, who played Pete Killiam. We spoke about Carl during our episode on The Ring, and this is his second of two appearances in a Hitchcock film. Malcolm Keane played Philip Christian. Keane was an English actor of the stage, film, and television. He was born in Bristol, and he made his stage debut in 1902 and his first film in 1916. Keane was an early collaborator with director Hitchcock, starring in his silent films The Mountain Eagle, The Lodger, and The Manxman. In April 1927, Keane appeared in Packing Up, a short film made in the DeForest Phonofilm sound-on-film process. The film also featured Mary Claire and was directed by Miles Mander. Annie Ondra, who played Kate Cregan, was a Czech film actress. She was married to German boxing champion Max Schmeling. She was born Anna Sophie Ondrakova in Tarnow, Glacia, Austria-Hungary, which is now Poland, and died in Hohenstedt near Hamburg, Germany. At 17, she played in the theater and acted in her first film. The film was directed by her boyfriend, director Karl Lamach. When her family learned of it, they had a shouting match in which the teenager received a beating from her father. To be an actress soon after the First World War was socially almost at the level of being a beggar. Anna preferred a film career and began to live with Karl Lamach. She was quoted as saying, "I swim like a fish, ride like a cowboy, and I would do it all if the film required it." She summarized that when she was 19 years old. After some years, she wanted to begin a family, but Lamach did not want to marry. So after a three-year romance, on the 6th of July, 1933, Ondra married German boxer Max Schmeling, with whom she appeared in the film Knockout from 1935. Their marriage was a happy one, although childless. Ondra miscarried after a car accident in 1936 and could no longer have children. They were married until she died in 1987. Now, Ondra formed a production company called Ondra Lamach Films with her boyfriend, director Karl Lamach. Lamach directed her in several silent films and acted with her in films directed by other filmmakers and continued to work together after her marriage with Max. Lamach remained her friend throughout his lifetime, and he died in her arms in 1952 in Hamburg. Throughout their marriage, German fascists tried to exploit the fame and popularity of Ondra and Schmeling. They were often seen in photos with Goebbels and Hitler, Max as a German Superman and Annie as a blonde Aryan, and Max was the heavyweight champion of the world between 1930 and 1932. However, they never collaborated, and Max refused to accept honors and even secretly helped to hide two Jewish children, saving their lives. In Nazi Germany, this was a capital offense. After the war, they were penalized financially for collaboration, and an arrest warrant was issued in the Czech Republic. Nazi propaganda was taken literally, and Schmeling never visited Ondra's homeland.
Wow.
That's quite the history. Yeah, that's some pretty interesting stuff. Now, she will also appear once again in Blackmail. We'll see her one more time. And the last actor I have to talk about is Randall Ayrton, who played Caesar Cregan. Ayrton was educated at the King's School, Chester, and Geneva University. In 1890, he made his stage debut at the Old Avenue Theatre in London, and was successful on stage in London and America in the late 30s. In 1913, he began his film career with the Old London Film Company, going from silence to talkies for a number of film companies thereafter. He also produced and directed several films. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. And finally, there is no Hitchcock appearance in this film.
Hmm.
So that is my epic notes section for this episode.
Very detailed. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Is it wrong that I really want to see a film about Max Schmeling and Annie Ondra now? Because, like, that sounds pretty awesome. They had a very happy marriage. He saved, you know, the lives of Jewish kids in World War II. I'm like, that sounds really good.
Maybe you can draft the film.
We could draft the film and write it. Even that she, you know, stayed friends with this former boyfriend of hers and worked with him and created a company with him, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's pretty awesome.
That is pretty awesome. I like that.
Well, should we hand off to Tom for the summary of the film?
I have a very good summary here from the book It's Only a Movie by Charlotte Chandler, and it belongs to Brandon, so I apologize for all the pen marks I've been making on the pages. Close friends Pete, a fisherman, and Phil, a lawyer, are both in love with Kate. Kate loves Phil, but he aspires to be a judge, and she is only an innkeeper's daughter. Pete is rejected by Kate's father because he is penniless, so he leaves for South Africa to make his fortune. Kate promises to wait for him, and Phil promises to look after her. Kate, hearing that Pete is dead, seduces Phil. I'm sorry, that's hard not to laugh at. When Pete arrives home, Phil convinces Kate that she must keep her promise to Pete. Pete, now wealthy, marries Kate. Phil insists Pete must never know that her child is not his. Soon after, Kate leaves Pete and her child to live with Phil, who is now a judge. Kate returns for her child, but Pete refuses to give up the baby, and Kate attempts suicide. So then Kate is brought before Phil as an attempted suicide in court. He discharges her into Pete's custody, but Kate declares that she loves another man, and the father, Caesar, shouts out that it is the judge. Phil has to resign, and he leaves with Kate and the baby, his career ruined, and Pete is left alone. It's quite a dramatic film.
Yeah.
I don't like Kate or Pete.
Pete is a bit of a Gilligan, right? He's a bit of a goofy guy. He's hard to take seriously.
Yeah.
Right. Now, Chris, I wanted you to read the note. Do you have it up in front of you?
Oh, yep. Yeah. Hang on a sec.
Okay, so they think that this... I really want to start here. So they think that this guy died. This guy, Pete, has died in an accident, which is fine, right? So they fall in love. They spend more time together, and now they realize that they can, you know, love each other and be married or whatever, because they had feelings that were developing while yeah. Pete was gone. They get this note that Pete's dead. However, shortly thereafter, Pete writes back, and this is what the letter says.
I both love and hate this note, so please be ready. Dear old Phil, they said I had been killed, but I wasn't. Which I love, because I really wish it had been like they said I'd been killed. They were right. This is coming from beyond the grave. No, alright. They said I had been killed, but I wasn't. Instead, I have made money. I'm coming home and shall arrive almost as soon as this letter. Don't tell Kate. I want it to be a surprise to her. Your old friend, Pete. Okay.
This is problematic.
This is so dumb.
It's like, guess what? I'm really alive. Like,
don't tell her. Like, I want to see her face when I show up.
Yeah. Surprise! Like, guess who's not dead?
It's quite a plot jump that they don't explain how he is suddenly alive when they thought he was dead. Like, they don't bother explaining how that happened, right?
Okay, so this is what I assumed. Like, just my logical head canon or whatever. I just assumed he was in a boating accident, in a storm, the boat tipped over, they couldn't find his body, and then he washed up on shore or something. So that's that, because he was fishing, right? I'm guessing he was fishing because he was a fisherman up here, right? I'm like, either way, it doesn't really matter, but not telling her, like, don't tell her that I'm alive. Like, just continue this charade of me being dead so that I can surprise her. Like, there's so much problems with this. This is such a problematic plot element for me.
It's kind of like he's thinking, this will be clever and funny if I suddenly show up alive.
She'll get a kick out of this.
Yeah. This will be a hoot.
Yeah.
Like,
we'll look back up this fondly and go, do you remember the time I thought you were dead for 6 months? And then you weren't!
Yeah, it's a little bit of a jump.
I swear there's like a spate of this in movies in like the 30s and 40s. There's so often, and it's also kind of a Miss Marple, Agatha Christie thing, in that loads of people seem to have been presumed dead and then mysteriously turned up again, and it's just... It makes me chuckle. It really, genuinely does. But to be honest, I wouldn't be that surprised. You know, you say the whole canon of it. I'd be that surprised if Pete just forgot to tell someone he was alive. Because he seems so dopey. He's just like...
By the way, or maybe he didn't even know. See, this letter doesn't need to be in the movie, right? Like, because let's say he just comes back because he didn't know that they told him. He didn't know the letter went back home and he just shows up.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, that's a better plot element. Or it's just time has passed and then he sends a letter and says, tell her I'm alive. And they thought he was dead and continued the romance in the meantime. You know, it's just that it's just a weird plot element that doesn't need to be there. It's very, very strange.
I get sort of why they included it, though. It just that it... If it had come as a complete surprise to both Philip and Kate, it would have been kind of equal on both their levels, whereas with this, it creates a bit of a power shift between them. because Phil knows this is coming, and right. yet he is, you know, he said he won't tell Kate or anything. So it's just, it's, I get why, because it's a little extra twist, it makes it a little more interesting and everything, but I feel really bad for saying this, but I really can't wait until we get to the Hitchcocks that actually have, like, more to the plot rather than love triangles, and that have a bit more kind of stuff going on, because I think as a relationship drama, I've seen a lot worse, but I've also seen the same thing about 4 dozen times across decades. So the fact this is a Hitchcock film where, you know, everybody ends up miserable at the end, it's not a she chooses him, it's no, they each end up destroying each other by, you know, kind of not being honest, not being kind of emotionally ready or anything. So I just, and you are right in that, I mean, I'll be honest, I sat through it, I didn't really feel anything for any of them. There was no likable character where I was like, do you know, I really hope it turns out all right for you.
Do you remember when we watched Downhill, right? And there was that weird brother bond between the men where they had this fraternal loyalty, they were going to protect each other.
Yeah, where it was like, listen, old Bean, you'll lie about, you know, the baby being yours, won't you? Of course I will.
Yeah, like I'll risk my academic career to save your reputation, sort of that really, really overdone fraternal loyalty. So in this film, the same thing happens where Philip is going to, oh yeah, I'll hang on to your girlfriend and keep her safe for you while you go off for an undefined amount of time. And, you know, I'll just ignore the fact that I like her and I'll just protect her for you. And they're supposed to be old friends. And it's just this weird, like, who would do that for another guy? Especially when there's love between, you know, Philip and Kate happening. But he's like, no, don't worry, Pete. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, I'll check your apartment once a week. I'll bring in your mail and check your newspaper for you. Like, it's just
take care of your girlfriend for
you. Yeah. Like, it's just a very a strange promise to make.
But not only that, it's like, you know, her father isn't even interested in this, in having Pete as the love interest for her daughter, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of got the impression that she wasn't really necessarily that interested in him anyways. What I got the impression of when he was standing on Philip's back, looking up in the window, talking to her, saying, will you wait for me while I go and make money? You know, she was joking around with Pete. You know, she was saying, yes, I will. No, I won't. Yes, I will. No, I won't. And he's like, come on, be serious for a minute here. And she's like, how are you up here? And she looks down and sees Philip. He's standing on Philip's shoulders. Like, I got the impression that both Philip and Kate were interested in each other even at that time. Because when Pete had mentioned to Philip, he's like, look, can you go in there and talk to her dad for me? Because I'm interested in her. And he's like, you're interested in her? And he's all sad.
Yeah,
but when this conversation happened, I got the idea that she wasn't really interested in that as well. So why did she make this promise to wait for him if she wasn't interested in him? Did you guys see that, or am I just reading into this?
I can see it. I'm just thinking. No, I mean, it is entirely possible that she has kind of, because of what we said we're going through in the film, that Philip's so focused on his career and he wants to be a Deemster and all that sort of thing, that Kate has gone, well, I would like to be with him, but he's too focused on his career and everything. However, Pete is clearly in love with me, you know.
And if Philip is holding him up to talk to me to ask him to wait, then probably Philip's not interested in me either.
Yeah.
That's how I read into it as well.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, but I mean, like, if she had just said no at that time, then, again, I don't know. Like, it's these plot elements that just don't quite work. Now,
Yeah.
Does it seem weird that we don't really learn how Pete made his money? He just says, I'm going to go off and work and come back with a bunch of money, and then he comes back with a bunch of money. But we don't really learn what happened that he made the money. Do we need to know that, or?
That doesn't bother me.
No.
Not knowing. Don't ask, don't tell.
No.
Don't look in his trunk.
The other thing that kept throwing me is that this whole film's a bit like part of the first season of Homeland. Because that love triangle that goes on between Brody, his wife, and his best mate. And it's just, it reminded me a lot of it, like the parallels and everything. And I was there just going like, Oh, when's somebody going to shoot somebody?
It's not as good as the first season of Homeland.
Yeah, that is true. But it was just, it was the whole idea of like, okay, a guy goes away, he's presumed dead, his wife grieves his best friend, they end up getting together, however, the guy who was presumed to be dead comes back, and then it's like, kind of like, oh, yeah, I said I'd wait for you, didn't I? Let's let this uncomfortable relationship continue, because you didn't cheat, technically, because I thought, you know, you were in prison, or you were away, or you know, thought you were dead. But I thought you were dead, so I moved on. So it's... There's a really good book as well, I can't remember the name of it, but it talks about the same thing, which is that a woman's lost at sea for about a year. She's then rescued, comes back, and her husband's married another woman, because he thought she was dead.
Yeah.
And it's the awkwardness of being like, right, okay, I can't actually see my kids anymore. I can't do this, I can't... do that as like the first Mrs. whatever her name is, but it's I for a romantic drama and relationship drama, like I said, I don't think it's bad. I think that it's very, there's a lot of plot for such a short film.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that goes on, particularly for, you know, like an 80-minute film back in 1929, when I was thinking maybe they'll do something more simplistic. I think it is in comparison as well, because some of the films we've done have been no plot.
Right, like
champagne. Like, you know, Downhill or Champagne or that sort of thing, where they're just, it's paper thin, it is just fizz. Whereas with this, if you took the time out and explored the characters a bit and made it a bit more kind of concrete, and you actually liked the characters, I think it'd work a lot better. Because when you start off, you know who Pete, Philip, and Kate are, but I, you know, I've said it, I'm sure you guys have, which is that I don't really connect with any of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and Hitchcock, for all of his faults, he does, when he puts the time to develop the characters in, he can make really engaging characters. You know, he is a plot-driven director, but it is, you know, you do need some characters to ground it, even if it's literally just a two-minute scene that sketches out who this person is. You know, we know that Philip wants to be, you know, a deepster. We know that Kate's caught between two guys. We know that Pete is like this hopeless romantic fisherman, but we don't know anything else. That's literally, that is their type. But we never get anything else. And it is a shame, because I think the film does have a lot going for it. I mean, no doubt we'll talk about the technical stuff in a bit, because it is a gorgeous rendition of this film. It is worth pointing out that the version we watched was kind of crystal clear. It was a gorgeous transfer. It was a brilliant way of updating everything. And it was just... I think it made a lot of the other stuff kind of really stand out. And I do feel more favourably towards this one, because... you know, on an aesthetic level, it's really easy to be able to tell what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly for a silent film, when a lot of it, you do have to, like, read the emotions on the faces. You can't take it from dialogue. It is very much kind of show, don't tell. So I did enjoy that. So, Adam, I mean, what did you... What would you have done to improve the plot with this? Like, if you were the script doctor or whatever... and they said, right, okay, we're going to start shooting this, but it needs a bit of work. What would you guys do?
I think you're right there. It was very busy for the length of the film. Yeah. There was a lot going on, and it really moved quickly. And I don't know how you would fix that, though.
See, the only thing that I could think would be, I'd get rid of the letter.
Yeah.
And, you know, have them fall in love and have him come back. And have a completely different type of confrontation at the end, where these people have fallen in love and had a life and had a child, and now this guy has come back, and it's like, look, we thought you were dead, and deal with that kind of ramification afterwards. Like, because they didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's happened before where, you know, people fall in love, they go to school, and they fall out of love. You know, like, maybe even that's what happened with her. You know, she fell in love, she fell out of love when he was gone, and fell in love with Philip. And when they found out that he was dead, she's like, okay, she's relieved. Okay, well, now we can focus on us now, and we don't have to hide it. Right?
Right.
And then And then this letter, even still, the letter comes quite a bit later. At least that's the impression that I get. You know, like, we haven't even talked about yet the fact that she gets pregnant by Philip.
Yeah.
Which is a very fascinating topic for him to cover, especially in 1928. Yeah. You know, and this coming out in 1929. I mean, like, we had the last film, Easy Virtue, where the woman was divorced twice. And, like, the social ramifications of that and her social stature. And here, we've got an unmarried woman who's pregnant.
Right.
You know, like, nowadays, that's no big deal. But in 1928, I'm pretty sure, like, I'm not familiar with 1928, but I think that would have been an issue back then.
Yeah.
You know, to be not married and to be pregnant. So, you know, Pete thinks that this is his baby. And when she decides to leave him, she finally has had enough, and she leaves the house to go be with Philip. He's taking care of this baby like it's his own, and she wants to come back and take the baby from him, you know?
There was a lot of baby abuse happening, too. There's a lot of leaving the baby alone in the house by himself or herself.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, near the fire, too.
Yeah.
So that's part of the reason why I didn't like this woman as well, because of the decisions that she made. Because, yeah, that totally stood out for me as well, where he comes home, she's off to confess herself to Philip, and Pete comes home, and it's like, hey, babe, where are you? And she's not here, but the baby's just there in the crib. Well, not even a crib. It's like a manger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe, I don't know if that was part of her character, that she was careless, or she was off the edge, like she didn't love the baby anymore, she didn't care anymore.
Which is fascinating, because it's Philip's baby.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is the person that she wants to be with, you know? So, I don't know, I think that's interesting, and I mean, I'm okay with not liking a character, right? I mean, like, I give credit to the fact that this character was written to the point where I didn't like her, yeah. And I'm okay with not liking a character. I don't have to like every character, because, you know, there's some conflict in this plot with this character, the way that she's portrayed. But I think it's really interesting writing choices that they've taken, and I do think a lot of Easy Virtue when I'm watching this film, because it ends in such a downer ending, you know?
Right,
yeah.
Same with Easy Virtue. Like, you know, it's not quite as downer as an ending, but it's almost.
Well, he was only a Deemster for like 2 days, wasn't he?
I think it was his first day.
Yeah.
The timing is tough, because she's like pregnant, and then the next scene she's giving birth, and, you know, like, it's the timing of how this stuff happens is fudged a little bit, I think.
But, oh, no, that happens on the Isle of Man.
Babies are born quicker?
It's something to do with the environment. It does, like, conduce them a lot quicker. So you can be
Is
like...
Is that like on Family Guy, when they feed Stewie the wolf's milk in Russia? The wolf's breast milk in Russia?
No, I've not seen that one, but I can immediately envision... Family Guy. Yeah, okay.
In, like, Russia, they feed their kids wolf breast milk or something. I think it's Family Guy. I'm sure it's Family Guy. I can't remember.
It's probably going to be Family Guy. But no, yeah, I mean, the whole pregnancy thing, you know, because we are talking, I think it's still pre-Hays Code and everything, so people could talk about kind of divorce and, you know, abortion and pregnancy and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I think it does speak to Kate. It's weird, Kate's character just seems to be inconsistent, and that seems to be a trait, if that makes sense. So she falls in love with... She says she's going to marry one guy, but she may secretly be in love with the other guy. Then she has the baby out of wedlock and then abandons it. She then tries to kill herself and then decides to, you know, take the baby and all that sort of thing. So I just... Yeah. It sounds awful. It generally sounds awful. But I was fully expecting this to end in, like, an even darker ending. I was fully expecting it to be like, okay... Kate, you know, throws herself into the river or the key or whatever and kills herself, and then it's a dark morality tale about kind of like, oh, well, that's what happens when you sleep around, that sort of thing. I mean, the only kind of comfort I can get from it, because it is a downer ending, but it does have Philip and Kate and the baby kind of walking away. Yes, they're, you know, they've still got their lives, they can still move away and start something, and you know, do all that sort of thing. And Pete is, you know, heartbroken, because that's the one thing I did feel really sorry for him, that he was shown to be quite a good dad.
Right.
And quite a positive, like, male role model. And just to have that taken away, that was the proper devastating part for me, was to see him, lose everything, in particular the baby. I think if it had just been, you know, Kate doesn't love him, she's in love with Philip, I think that would have been hard, but he would have been able to handle it. Whereas losing the baby he thought was his, that's quite severe. That's quite a brutal, you know, thing to take. Imagine that. Imagine, you know, you think you've, you know, you're a newborn dad and all that sort of thing, and then a few months down the road, it's like, no, the baby, not only isn't yours, but you're never going to see it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this whole thing could be like an episode of Maury. It really could. You know, or for our UK listeners, the Jeremy Kyle show, which is, it's a bit like Maury if the guests were lowbrow.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I'm not even joking. That's not me being like, oh, if they were lowbrow. I'm like, no, the ones at Jeremy Kyle don't have teeth.
But, like, don't get me wrong. I mean, like, for it may sound like I'm negative on it. Like, it's such a downer movie and a downer ending, but yeah. I really enjoyed this movie.
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. And I'm surprised that Hitchcock is so dismissive of it with that quote that he had in the Truffaut book.
Right.
I mean, it could have been that he was just maybe tired of the silent thing, or maybe, you know, as evidenced by the stuff he then moves on to, when we look at kind of his stuff in the 30s and 40s and 50s, he wanted stuff that was a bit darker or a bit deeper. Mm-hmm. So it could be that he's just dismissing it in the same way he dismisses stuff like, you know, Champagne or The Lodger or The Mountain Eagle or whatever it is, just because it was like, oh, okay, it was all, you know, it was all like a prelude to my proper stuff. In the same way that, you know, if you, you know, say if you're a writer, the first few articles you write might be okay, but until you get to the proper really good one, they're all just kind of like a run-up, they're a, you know, a test run, that sort of thing. So, I don't think I'd ever watch the film again. Do I think it's a bad film? No. Mm-hmm. I just think it's one that could do with a bit of polish, another and a bit rewrite. Paring down. A good rewrite and a good trim down.
Tom, what are your final thoughts on the film?
Well, technically speaking, like you said, the version we were able to watch was amazing, the restoration. And I want to thank Pat McFadden, who's one of the Alfred Hitchcock geeks, for his interest in our show. I had some good conversations with him, and he was able to point us towards this version of the film that we all were able to watch. Did we find that the film would have been difficult in general to find online?
Well, I had it on DVD. It's a part of my collection. Right. But what I noticed is, I think that the DVD version that I have was, like, not the proper speed.
Right.
Because I watched a few minutes of the DVD, because my DVD version was 100 minutes, I think. And the version we watched was 80 minutes. So I watched the first 5 minutes, and I'm like, this doesn't look like it's moving in the right speed. I wonder if the version is just slowed down a bit somehow. And so I watched the first 5 minutes of the other one, and I'm like, well, I can't even go back to my DVD because this looks so good. But I think watching it on the version that we had, I'm like, well, this looks the same. It's just at a different speed. So I didn't have trouble finding it because it's a part of the 20 movies on 4 DVD collection that I have.
Well, and I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong. It's a heavy film. There's a lot going on. There's a lot to follow. And which is, of course, difficult in the silent film format. But it was enjoyable, and it's a bit of a tragic ending. I think Philip, the fact that he was able to be a judge or a deemster, and that he had been working as a professional lawyer, I think he'll go on and do fine career-wise. Like, he'll be able to open a law office and, you know, keep practicing. I don't think he'll have any trouble starting his career back up at the end. But no, I enjoyed it. I think it was the fact that there was so much going on did make it interesting. It did make you pay attention. And I don't think I'd watch it again in any hurry, but it was definitely a film worth watching.
Good.
I rate this film a flag with three weird legs.
I give it three smoky pipes in a pub out of five.
I'm trying to think now. Three background extras who were supposed to be women, but who are clearly men. Yes, it is. In the last shot, I promise you that there is. Yeah.
Boy, those neighbors were judgmental, hey?
Yeah. I know. Well, you see, I've watched it in that scene. And they're all going like, boo, you.
Hussy.
Well, yeah, harlot. All that sort of thing. And I swear to God, there's a row of women judging, and it's woman, 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 and then it's a guy with the cloak.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be like, you know, oh, you like that sort of thing. I'm like, okay, all right, so you rang out of female extras. Okay, fair enough.
They weren't throwing potatoes.
No.
Almost.
Now, I had asked you guys, I'd like you to, what are your top three of the silent, now that we're done the silent era,
ooh,
what would you say are your top three of the silent films? So, Tom, let's go with you first. What are your three favorites that we've
got? I would agree with your ranking where you put The Lodger at number one. I think The Lodger was very interesting. I found The Ring very entertaining, for sure, and I didn't get to see Easy Virtue, but I think I'll have to put Manxman probably at number three of these very entertaining films for what they were.
Yeah, they were. Like, I have my ranking. I'm on Letterboxd if you want to follow me, Brandon Botella. I'm creating a ranking system of the Hitchcock films as I go along, and I have The Lodger, The Manxman, and The Ring as my top three.
Fair enough.
Which I really enjoyed this movie a lot. Like, for my critiques of it while we're watching it here, I really enjoyed it. And talking about it with you guys, I actually enjoy it more.
Yeah.
You know, like, this conversation has actually helped me appreciate the film a bit more. And, I mean, I gave the film a 3.5 rating out of 5. I mean, like, it's a very solid rating for a movie, you know? Yeah. But I would definitely recommend you check it out.
Yeah.
So, Chris, what are your top three?
My top three, I mean, I'm the same with you guys for number one. It's got to be The Lodger. That's classic. Yeah. For number two, I have a bit of a soft spot for The Farmer's Wife. Because it's a genuine comedy and everything. I can kind of get behind that. And then number three is probably The Manxman, actually. I just think it was really well done. Even though it ends on a bittersweet ending, it is technically quite a good film. So I'm happy with that.
Well, that's it for our silent era. Coming up next time, for sure, is going to be Blackmail. But we're going to try and squeeze a couple episodes in between. We were talking before we started recording that we want to try and cover some of the remakes of the films. They won't be too in-depth discussions. We're thinking maybe 15 minutes an episode, something like that. And it's going to be interesting coming up here because Tom's work schedule's changing a little bit. So we're going to have to work out how we record because, you know, while Tom and I are in Saskatchewan here, I work Monday to Friday, and Tom works weekends, and Chris is in England. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to try and come up with a time for us all to record together. So you might see a couple episodes where we're splicing together segments where, you know, Tom might pipe in with his thoughts while Chris and I host the main episode, or, you know, Tom and Chris will host the main episode and I'll just pipe in with my trivia and behind the scenes or something like that. So the format of the show might be changing a little bit, but we'll see how that goes over the next little bit. Chris has also volunteered to stay up late on Friday nights if we need to. So we might be able to do it Friday after work or something like that. But Chris is a trooper. We love Chris.
Oh,
so excellent. Well, be sure to check out the Fandom Podcast Network, which we are always a part of. They're good friends of ours. They've got lots of great shows like Blood of Kings, Couch Potato Theater, and Culture Clash. So be sure to check out the Fandom Podcast Network. We're in their master feed. We do have our own independent feed as well now. Also, please be sure to check out our good friends Annie and Catherine over on Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they're going through every episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the half an hour original version. And it's a lot of fun. I find myself laughing along when I listen. I'm watching along for the first time. So it's really interesting. They've had some really good episodes. And I'm looking forward to their next discussion. I can't remember the name of the episode, but it was really kind of a dark episode. It was really, really interesting. So, so I guess that's all that we got from us here. Chris, Where can people find you when you're not trying to pretend that you're dead still for your girlfriend who's secretly in love with your best friend?
Yes, when I'm not faking my death in an attempt to seek a fortune and then return to my ex-fiance, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. All I do on there is pretty much kind of chat enthusiastically about all kinds of stuff, so feel free to get in touch there. I do another podcast called North by Nerd West with one of my best friends, Emma Platt. We are recording this week and hopefully get an episode out as soon as, talking about the past month or so in kind of geek culture, so hopefully you'll be able to check us out on iTunes and Blogger.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not judging your neighbors for their sex lives?
I'm going to start hanging out in fishermen's pubs and have an amazingly smoky pipe. On Twitter, I'm known as TomCaldwell3000. Instagram, TheTomCaldwell. Don't accept any imitations. And, other than that, I like to hang around and talk about Hitchcock films with you guys whenever I have a spare moment.
And me, when I'm not trying to abandon my baby and find the true love of my life, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me over on the Trek FM network with a show called The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast, and Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast. Well, I guess that's it. Hey, guys?
Yeah, I think that's it. I hope you've enjoyed listening to the episode. Thank you again so much for checking us out. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. And I guess all that's left to say is good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.